That was easier than asking all of you to move forward, you see. Well, thank you very much for that very warm welcome and invitation. And it is good to be back at Heath. And it's always good to be able to say that you're back at a place. The story is told of a young trainee Methodist minister who had to preach what was rather dauntingly called a trial sermon. And he did so and was being monitored by a senior member of the denomination. And he really didn't do very well. But when it was over, the senior man invited him in to give his verdict on things. And to the young man's surprise, the man said, well, thank you for that. And I found your sermon moving, soothing, and satisfying. And the young man thought, the old boy's been fooled. I didn't think it was very good, but he obviously was impressed. However, before he could go very far down that line, the gentleman listening to him said, well, let me tell you what I meant by that. It was very moving. Because by the time you'd finished, a lot of people had walked out. And then it was very soothing because a lot of those who stayed behind had fallen asleep. And thirdly, it was very satisfying. I've heard you once and I really don't care to hear you again. Now, it's nice to think that at least 8 years after I was here last, and I remember being here on a number of occasions before that, I have been asked again. So thank you, sir, for that. And for the privilege of being with you tonight. What a wonderful crowd of people we have tonight. And I'm sure that for some of you at least, you are here not because of the speaker, but because of the subject. Where is God when things go wrong? Now, wherever you stand in the matter of faith, or the great phrase today is some faith or no faith, whatever you, though that at the moment is utterly irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. What we will all agree with, at least here's something that we can agree with before we go any further, is we live in a world where things go wrong. There is not a day when we're not conscious that things go wrong. I haven't had a chance to read a newspaper today. I've been dashing hither and yon and speaking elsewhere today. And so I haven't had a chance to read a newspaper. And the only news item I caught on the car radio was that due to modern technology and smartphones and so forth, there has been an alarming rise in the addiction to gambling among young people using their smartphones. And that's the only item of news I've heard. And that's not good news. Something has gone wrong. Yesterday, I did glance at a newspaper and read about 400,000 victims of a financial scandal. A young mother who died less than a month after giving birth to her first child, a 48-year-old man burned by a lynch mob. I had an email from a fellow Guernseyman yesterday in which he says, at the present time, Pat and I are on a Norwegian coastal cruise. We were supposed to be on board for another week, but unfortunately my brother, Martin's wife, Jill, suddenly died of a heart attack 10 days ago, and we have to attend the funeral on Friday. So we get off the boat at Tromso today and fly back and abandon the remainder of the trip. She was only 63. Every day there is bad news. Something goes wrong. And I'm speaking to hundreds of people tonight, and you don't have to go very far back in your life. Maybe even today or yesterday or last week or last month or certainly last year, and you could say, now that was something that went wrong. The announcement of a disease, a bad report from a doctor, unemployment, redundancy, a behavioral problem within the family, the cooling of a relationship between husband and wife, an accident, things go wrong. We live in a world where things go wrong. I was in Northern Ireland a couple of years ago and was told that the church had done a survey out on the street, and they had asked people, if you could ask God one question, what would it be? What a tremendous thing to be approached with in a poll on the street. If you could ask God one question, I mean, I could ask you that tonight. I won't, because we'd be here all night hearing the answers. If you could ask God one question, what would it be? Listen to this. 80% of those who replied said, we would ask him, where were you when that went wrong? 80% did. So this is a massive question. Whatever response we come up with, it is a huge question. I was in Belfast a few days ago, right at the spot of the Titanic Museum. You mention the word Titanic and everybody's mind goes back to 1912, the largest movable object then built by man. A ship so amazing, its owner said, not even God could sink this ship. And on its maiden voyage, struck that iceberg and 1,500 people lost their lives, the greatest then maritime disaster in history. 2004 at Christmas, the tsunami in the Far East. And I just wonder whether in those 9 years we have kind of forgotten how many people died as the result of the tsunami. 288,000 people. Where was God when that happened? 9/11, when those 19 terrorists hijacked four commercial airliners in the United States, flew two of them into the World Trade Center in New York, the other into the Pentagon in Washington, and a fourth, we believe, would have gone into the Capitol building or the White House were it not for the amazing courage of some of the passengers who overcame the terrorists and caused the plane to crash in a field in Pennsylvania with the loss of another 38 lives. By the end of that day, some 3,000 people had lost their lives. Where was God when that happened? But as I say, we can come closer than 9/11 and into our own lives and this very day. Accidents, disease, death, where is God? What I find fascinating is that the question is often asked by people who, I would guess, often don't bring God into the picture when things go well. They reach the end of a day and things have gone wonderfully well in their lives. They've had a rise or something, or they've heard good news or a good report from a doctor, or something that they would say, you know, this has been a great day. I merely ask the question, do those same people say we should now bow our heads and thank God that he was in this situation and has blessed us in this way? I've just got a hunch that they don't, but that when things go wrong, suddenly, well, where's God? And it's very interesting that in the Old Testament, there were skeptics and agnostics and atheists who said to people who did believe in God, where now is your God? Look what's going on. Well, now, where is your God? And I put it to you again, this is a valid question. I have no problem with people asking the question. I'd be quite surprised if they didn't, because it is a valid question. Now, why do they ask the question? I suggest to you that it's because of two things that they sort of believe about God, maybe not with any great conviction, and maybe not because of something they've been recently taught or issues with which they're really alive mentally, but maybe kind of back in the recesses of their memory, there are two things about God that they read about or heard about, might have been taught at Sunday school or in far-off days of some kind or another. And the two are these: that God is all-powerful, that God is God. I mean, he's in control of the universe. Now, however vague their understanding about that is, they are absolutely right. And the Bible's, to give just one sentence of confirmation of that, the Bible says that God works all things according to the counsel of his will. Let me put it to you as radically as I can. There's not a molecule in the whole universe that shifts position other than under God's control. And then if God is like that, well, how in the world do all these bad things happen? Oh, and there's something else. They would say, but I thought that God was supposed to be love. Well, they're absolutely right. In fact, the Bible sums it up in three words. God is love, which is not the same as saying that love is God. But God is love. And now do you see the question building up in their minds? We live in a world where there is evil and suffering. Things go wrong. Now, if God was all-powerful, he could prevent all these things going wrong. And if he was all-loving, he would want to prevent all those things going wrong. Therefore, Now, think it through with them. Therefore, he is either not all-powerful, or he's not all-loving, or he doesn't exist. Now, do you see how the question is asked and what the argument is that lies behind it? During the ruthless ethnic cleansing in Kosovo in the 1990s, some soldiers decided to take 10 ladies from their families and rape them by the roadside. And they said, "No, we're not going to kill you, but we are going to rape you, and we want your families to be present." And when that terrible ordeal was over, one of the victims told the world's media, "It was then that I came to know that God does not exist." And we can't imagine, I imagine nobody in this building can quite imagine what happened. But I'm going to dare to say I can understand her telling the media that. I can. Look, I'm on her side in understanding why she would ask that question. It was there, or make that statement, it was then that I came to know that God does not exist. Well, let me begin, you may think very unusually, let's take that on board and say, well, let's just imagine he doesn't exist. Well, where does that get us? So God does not exist and things go wrong. So where does that get us? Well, let me tell you one problem it solves immediately. And that is that there's no point in asking the question. So the question is no longer a problem. If there's no God, where is God when things go wrong is not an issue. The only people who have a problem with the question is people who believe that God exists. Do you get that? I mean, if God doesn't exist, well, it's not a question that causes any bother at all because it wouldn't even be asked. But really, where does it get us? The best-known atheist in the world, I guess, beyond any shadow of a doubt, is a man called Richard Dawkins. If you've never heard of Richard Dawkins, welcome home from planet Zog. Richard Dawkins, at a time, I think, when a group of young people were killed in a car wreck on the M4, as I recall, was asked, well, what do you make of this? And Dawkins said, well, this is what we should expect. Now, I'm quoting word for word. If we live in a universe in which there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares, he went on. DNA just is, and we dance to its music, unquote. Did you hear that? So here's a person who doesn't have a problem with our question, where is God when things go wrong? He doesn't believe that God exists. And what he says happens is this: DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. So when things go wrong in your life, all you have to say is, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles, if I can mix my analogies now. That's just what DNA did, and let's move on. I guess move on to the next thing that goes wrong, and then they blame that on DNA as well. Peter Atkins, who used to lecture in physical chemistry at Lincoln College, Oxford, said that humanity, and I'm quoting word for word, is just a bit of slime on a planet, unquote. Now, I don't know if that's what he calls his wife, but that's his problem and not mine. But if Peter Atkins is right, see, I want to take the atheist's case here. If Peter Atkins is right, and we are just a bit of slime on a planet, why should we bother when children are abused? Why should paedophilia be a worry to us? Why should we care if teenagers get stoned, if old people get mugged, if people get murdered and raped, if divorce happens, if accidents occur? Why should we care a hoot if we're just a bit of slime on a planet? Follow me carefully. If there is no God, what one animal does to another animal is morally irrelevant, whether the animals concerned have two legs or four legs or none. If there is no God, murder is no more serious than having dandruff on your collar. And you say, no, no, that's overstating the case. Well, it isn't. So there. And if you think I'm wrong, you're wrong. Because I'm right. So let me say it again. If there's no God, I mean, God is totally out of the picture. You tell me the moral difference between murder and having dandruff on your collar. If you think you know the difference, be my guest. If there is no God, the moral issue simply doesn't arise. Let me illustrate about 9/11. 9/11 was a noisy, spectacular, colorful, exciting redistribution of atoms and molecules. Now, you've never heard that said about it before, so let me say it again, and then you'll have heard it twice. 9/11 was a spectacular, noisy, colorful rearrangement of atoms and molecules. Yeah, it was that. And as far as atheism is concerned, that's all it was. But now let me come to the defense of the atheists. Because there were atheists in the NYPD, in the fire department, in the hospitals, in the operating theaters, in the wards, in counseling rooms. There were, among all the thousands of those involved in that, there were people who were atheists. And let me tell you what they did with their atheism. They threw it out of the window. And they treated people the way I would expect someone who, frankly, is a committed Christian, believing that God created us in his own image. We'll come to that much later. They treated them with care and with love. They lavished their skills on them. They wore themselves out to help them. I can still see the picture of those firemen walking up the steps of the World Trade Center. I heard the other day that as some of them went up, they wrote their name and their telephone number on their arms because they really believed that they would not come back. And when their bodies were found, they wanted identification to be easy. Does that sound like someone who believes that humanity is just a bit of slime on a planet? Now, be honest. Does it? Or does that sound like the action of somebody who says, we are meaningful and we mean something to certain people. And so this is my name and this is my phone number so that if my charred body is found, I can be identified more quickly. So that's where we get, if there is no God. Even asking the question is a waste of time. Oh, and we're totally on our own. If there is no God. Now, the great thing about meetings like this is I don't know who in the world you are. I probably don't know more than about 4 people in the building. And to our great embarrassment, I think Kynwynn Swan is here. I had the great privilege of learning at the feet of her husband and preaching at conventions with him. And 1 or 2 other people that I don't know, and that's about it. So I don't know whether you are a person of the Christian faith, some faith, no faith, and that really is immaterial But I just make the point again. If there is no God, the whole thing is entirely irrelevant. And we are on our own. So if you really don't believe in God, and things go wrong in your life, which they do. I don't mean all day and every day, but when things go wrong in your life, I've got some bad news for you. You're on your own. That's it. Tough. As Dawkins says, DNA just is, and we dance to its music. So if things go wrong in your life and there is no God, blame DNA. That's all you can do. A little while ago, there was a bunch of atheists who wanted to do thought for the day on Radio 4. And they made a big hoo-ha about it. Well, why don't we have thought for the day? All other kind of groups do thought for the day. Why can't we? One of my first naughty thoughts was, well, it might be better than some of the stuff we get, so give them a shot. And then I had second thoughts, and I said, you know, so I wrote a letter to the Daily Telegraph, which they published. And my letter said, I'd be very interested if atheists did thought for the day, but I would like to know what they would tell me that would bring a spring to my step and a glow to my cheeks and a sparkle in my eyes as I waited for a train to take me to work in the morning. Because their creed is, oh, and by the way, atheism as a belief system. There are no non-believers in the world. Don't you believe that there are non-believers? After all, an atheist believes there's no God, so he's a believer. And I said, their creed is, and they do have a creed. Atheism does have a creed. It's shorter than the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, the Athanasian Creed, the Westminster Confession of Faith, the Baptist Confession of Faith. It's much shorter than all of those. This is their creed. We began as a fluke, we live as a farce, and we end as fertilizer. That's it. That's the entire creed. An atheist tackled me at the end of one meeting and got really angry with me about that. And I said, well, excuse me, how did we get here? Was it planned, designed? He said, no. So I said, so it was a fluke. Well, yes, if you want to put it like that. And what's the meaning and the purpose of life ultimately? I mean, what are we here for? Do you have a? Can you give a meaning and a purpose and a structure to life? No. So it's a farce. What happens to us when we die? Well, he said, we die and we're buried and that's it. I said, and we become fertilizer. We become what the Puritans called worm's meat. Not very elegant, but decidedly true. So I said, so that is the atheist's creed. We began as a fluke, we live as a farce, and we end as fertilizer. So if you're here tonight as someone who says, well, I'm really here because the question fascinated me, but I really don't believe in God, well, you tell me afterwards when we meet around the refreshments and the books and the hall, you tell me if I've got this wrong. That your creed is, we began as a fluke, we live as a farce, and we end as fertilizer. All right. Well, now let's take the other line and say, let's imagine God does exist. Then there are some serious questions that need to be faced. And they need to be faced by the people who do believe that God exists. And there's what we could call natural evil. Floods and hurricanes and tornadoes and poisonous beasts and poisonous plants, for that matter. Where is God when those things happen? When they maim and disfigure and dismember and destroy us? And then there are accidents. Chernobyl in 1996, so the nuclear explosion, which rendered 800,000 children long-term liable to leukemia. I'm told that it will not be safe for people to live there for another 600 years. Where was God when that happened? And there are countless other accidents in the air, on the land, at sea, in the home, at work, on the playing fields. You name it, and an accident can happen there. There's no spot in the whole world that is accident-free. Where is God when those things happen? And then there's moral evil, man's inhumanity to man. World War I, I'm told there were 30 million people killed in World War I. And that was the war to end all wars. Except that a few years later, here came World War II. And there's been no official figure as to how many people were killed in World War II, but it's been estimated in terms of many more millions than that. Oh, and they did include 6 million Jews who were massacred by Hitler. He called them human bacteria, which I guess is just about on a par with Peter Atkins, a bit of slime on a planet. Well, these Jews aren't going to accomplish anything, and they've caused all sorts of trouble, so why don't we wipe them out and replace them with a good, new, strong Aryan race that will be the pride of Germany, the pride of Europe, and good for the whole of mankind. So he thought that was a very good thing to do. Well, where was God when 6 million Jews were wiped out? And doesn't the Bible say somewhere something about them being his people? Well, where was this powerful, loving God when that happened? And since the end of World War II, there have been 45 million violent deaths. Opponents of the dictator Mao Zedong in China were annihilated at the rate of 2,000 a month during the Cultural Revolution. Where was God? The Marxist dictator Pol Pot killed 1.5 million of his fellow Cambodians in the notorious killing fields in the course of 2 years. Where was God while that was going on? We seem to have forgotten the rapid accumulation of violent deaths in Syria, so that in the last few years, 100,000 30,000 people have been killed in what amounts to the civil war in Syria. Where is God while that is going on? And then the countless, literally countless cases of murder and violence and rape and child abuse and other crimes. Where is God? That's why we're here tonight. Where is God while all of that's going on? And then the worst thing that can happen to anybody, we would say, is that they die. And today, 250,000 people have died. Where is God while those people breathe their last and are now dead? So that's the question that we're asking, and is the reason why we're here tonight. That, in a nutshell, if you like, is the case against God. And I'm here in a Christian church, and I rejoice at being here because Heath has stood for many years as a bastion of biblical truth in this great city. And I'm so thankful for it, for its witness, its history, its foundation. Not really thankful for mobile phones, but we'll pass on that. That's just one of those other things that's gone wrong. And I'm grateful for the minister who is God's servant in this place tonight. And therefore, I would be expected to give a biblical perspective on where is God when things go wrong. But before I do, let me just say this and ask you to think about it very carefully. God exists independently of our particular needs and pleasures and wishes and hopes. God, let me put it this way, doesn't owe any of us comfort and pleasure and wealth and success, or even life. Now, if by an extraordinary happening, every single one of us was to die before the end of this meeting tonight, and I promise the minister will be through by 11:30, but if every one of us was to die tonight, God would not have shortchanged one of us. Not even the youngest would be able to say, "Hey, but look, I see some people here in their teens. God has shortchanged me. It's all right for that geriatric up on the platform, but God has shortchanged me." Wait a minute. God does not owe you another year, another month, another week, another day, another hour, another minute. So let's get that absolutely clear. God doesn't owe us any of these things. So, can we blame God when we don't have them? Then what does the Bible have to say? Where is God when things go wrong? Well, I have to begin by saying it doesn't actually give us detailed answers to every question that we could raise, every situation that we could raise around this subject. And I can hear the skeptic, and maybe you're here tonight, say, "Oh, well, there you go. You see, these Christians, they toddle along to Heath with their big Bibles, and they're told the Bible is the final authority in all matters of faith and practice." And then you ask them a big question, "Well, but yes, but where is God when things go wrong?" And they back off and say, "Well, it actually doesn't, I mean, not every single question that we could ask." In fact, the person who wrote more of the New Testament than anyone else, a man called Paul, who was an apostle, he says, and I paraphrase but capture the spirit of it, "Well, we can only see things rather dimly at the moment." And the word he uses, the original Greek word he uses, is the word from which we get the English word enigma, which means, okay, we've got the general picture, but that every little detail is not, at this time, absolutely clear. And so the skeptic says, "Well, there we are, you see, the Bible's not clear on everything that we could ask." Well, let me respond to that in these four ways. If God is transcendent, if he really is over and above and beyond us, he's not one of us or the best of us or the greatest of us, he's not, as some people horribly say, the man upstairs. If he is transcendent, surely there's bound to be an element of mystery in our understanding of the way God thinks and the way God acts. There's bound to be an element of mystery about it, and God steers us in that direction by saying in his word, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are my ways your ways." And secondly, leaving us with some questions is not the same as leaving us in the dark. And thirdly, the Bible doesn't tell us everything we want to know, but it does tell us everything we need to know. Everything we need to know about ourselves, about the world, about God, about whether we can get right with God, about death, and about what lies beyond death. The Bible tells us everything we need to know. And fourthly, it tells us a great deal about evil and suffering. And it goes back to square one. No, it goes back beyond square one. And it takes us back to the point when things didn't go wrong, to what we call creation. And when God had completed the work of creation, the universe, our planet, and our first parents, God's assessment, God's take on the whole shooting match was, God saw that it was very good. God saw that it was very good. I mean, everything was very good. Even the Higgs boson was very good. Would you say that's true now about our world? About Wales? About Cardiff? About your street? About your family? Or about you? Do you think that God's verdict on you would be, it's all very good? But that there was a time when that was true. And then something happened, and the Bible's economy of words is really quite staggering. It puts it in this way: sin entered the world. Four words to describe the greatest catastrophe there's ever been on our planet. When for the very first time, our first parents decided not to obey God, not to live as God wanted them to live, but to do their own thing, go their own way, flash their fist in God's face. When God said yes, they said no. When God said no, they said yes. And a whole catalogue of catastrophe followed. First of all, their relationship with God was broken. Their relationship with each other was broken. And instead of love and trust, there was distrust and suspicion, and the blame game began. Their relationship with the world in which they lived, that too was shattered. Oh, and beyond that, the whole cosmos was thrown out of sync. There were no tsunamis and floods and earthquakes and hurricanes and all the rest of it until sin entered the world. And now, and the Bible has a very pictorial description about it, the world is in bondage to decay. That's what the Apostle Paul wrote. If he'd been a scientist, he would have said, now we are subject to the second law of thermodynamics, which simply means the available energy in our planet is just gradually disappearing. Things are cracking up and breaking down. Things are going wrong, universally and cosmically. And something else happened, because that's not just an issue that was true many, many thousands of years ago. And let me try to illustrate for you. God created man in his own image, which doesn't mean the same size and shape as God is neither size nor shape. But God created man in his own image, that is, in a relationship with himself. Man fell into sin, and then we are told, and the words are quite specific, we're then told that he, Adam, fathered children, and listen to the wording, in his own likeness, in his own image. Do you notice the repetition of the phrase? God creates man in his perfect image. Man becomes a sinner, depraved, corrupt, godless, self-centered, and then produces children in that fallen, depraved, corrupt, self-centered image. And their children others, and their children others, until you came along. So you're part of that stream, that polluted stream of humanity. Some years ago, the Times offered its readers to answer the question, what's wrong with the world? And lots of letters came in, and the best letter of all was the shortest. Let me tell you what the entire letter was. I'll read the entire letter for you. Don't forget the subject is, what's wrong with the world? Here's the letter. Sir, I am yours faithfully, G.K. Chesterton. That was the letter. And he was saying, you want to know what's wrong with the world? Well, I am. And so if you ask me tonight, what's wrong with the world? Here's my answer. Wait for it. You are. You are. I thought, I'm looking at you. You are what's wrong with the world. How dare you? I mean, 9/11, 6 million Jews killed, rape, violence, murder, all that. And you say, no, I didn't say you were responsible for those things. I am saying that you have made your contribution to what's wrong with the world. And as I point a finger at you, I've got three fingers pointing back at me, because I'm what's wrong with the world too. And I've never yet met anybody who would say, well, only one, and I'll tell you about her in a moment, who would say, well, I've never done anything wrong. I was speaking at a large house meeting of ladies in Scotland a few years ago, which is different from a meeting of large ladies, but not very. At some point, I mentioned the issue of forgiveness, I think, and I noticed a lady out of the corner of my eye. And you better be careful when you're sitting in church. The preacher's got very wide vision. And I noticed, and I thought, I don't think she's with this at all. And so I said, excuse me, do you have a problem with what I just said? Yes, I do. Well, have you never asked for forgiveness? No. Well, why not? Don't you think you've ever done anything for which you need to be forgiven? And she said, no. So I now took a chance. I knew it was a pretty small, closely knit community. So I turned to the other ladies and said, do you know this lady? And all their heads went like this. Oh, yeah, we know this lady. And then I said, now tell me, do you think she's absolutely perfect? And suddenly it was like watching Wimbledon. All the heads were doing this instead. And that pretty soon put her in her place. And of course, you and I know perfectly well that we are part of what's wrong with the world. Let's not get behind the headlines and say, well, that's that, but this is me. And if you think, well, I'm still not comfortable with that, well, I hope you're not. Just imagine that in the wonders of modern technology, we would have put a screen up here and we were going to show a person's entire life in 30 minutes. Because you could put something on your head and it would condense everything. But you would see everything in 30 minutes. A person's entire life, I mean everything. Not only everything they did in public and in private, but everything they said, every word, and everything they thought would be there on the screen and you could get it. I'm telling you what, you people would be moving here so you get a good view. I mean, this would be really worth seeing. But before you shuffle into a good position to watch it, I've got some news for you. It's your life we're going to be showing. And if I said that was going to happen, there'd be scorch marks on the carpet as you made for the exit. Why? If there's a single person here who would dare to look me in the eye and say, John, I wish that were available, and I would happily sit here and let everybody in Heath see exactly everything I've thought, said, and done for my entire life. And if you say, I'd be happy to do that, I've got one word for you. You're a liar. Of course you know perfectly well. You would be embarrassed to death if that were to happen. I certainly would. I wouldn't like you to see everything I've thought, said, and done in the last month. I wouldn't. So what's wrong with the world? Well, you and I are. And there's something else that is the result of that. And let me give it to you in the words of the Bible exactly. Sin entered the world through one man and death through sin. And in this way, death came to all men because all sinned. And so what happens as the result of sin is what the Bible calls death. Which, incidentally, in the Bible, death never means termination, it means separation. And the Bible speaks of death in two ways. First of all, the spirit is separated from God. That's what happened with our first parents. They sinned, and their spirit was separated from God. They no longer had that living relationship with Him. And the second part of it is, the spirit is separated from the body. I've been present when someone has died. And the moment after they've died, they're still there. It's an interesting phrase that is commonly used. So-and-so has passed away. Does that mean they're not there? I was holding my stepmother's hand when she died. And someone might have said, well, your mother has passed away. And I would say, actually, she's still there. But her spirit had left her body. And that is the penalty for sin is death. The spirit is separated from God, and eventually the spirit is separated from the body. Oh, and it gets worse. Left to ourselves, please remember those words, left to ourselves, we are sinners, and therefore under the righteous anger of a holy God who has zero tolerance of sin. So we have offended God. We've broken His law. We are separated from Him. We are exposed rightly to His righteous anger. Oh, and it gets worse. That if we go on like that until the end of life, left to ourselves, please remember those words, left to ourselves, we will then be under His wrath and judgment and condemnation forever. And you say, well, is that really the Bible's central message? No, it's not, and I'll come to it in just one moment. But I do want to press home this point, that we are exposed, left to ourselves, unless God intervenes. That is our position, and will be forever. And I've heard people say, well, do you really believe in hell? And how could a God of love, remember that at the beginning? How could a God of love send anybody to hell? There is a sense in which God doesn't send anybody to hell. People send themselves there. Well, how do you make that out? Well, the best way I know to do that is to repeat some words that Jesus said. Light is come into the world, and men prefer darkness to light, and will not come to the light, lest their deeds be exposed. Now, I don't come to Cardiff very often, but I'm going to say this about the people who live in Cardiff and this area, not as a criticism, simply as a comment. And I'm pretty sure I'm right, although I've never asked people, I've never told people to tick boxes and see if this is correct or not. Most people in this city did not get up this morning and thank God for the gift of a new day and for His blessing and safety during the night. Most people in this city did not turn to this book, the Bible, and read something from it and ask God to help them to understand it and to live it out. Most people in this city did not say, what I really want to do this day is to live in a way that will be pleasing to God. Most people in this city were not in a place of public worship last Sunday and don't intend to be on this coming Sunday. Now, hear me carefully. I'm not criticizing any of that. I'm simply reciting facts. Why is that? I know that there's a measure of local government in Wales and so forth, but as far as I know, and I'm not a political animal, as far as I know, there's no law in this country that says you must not thank God. You must not thank God for your food. You must not thank Him for a night's rest. You must not commit your day to Him. You must not seek to live a godly life. You must not read His word, and you must not go to church on Sunday. As far as I know, there's no law in Wales that says that's the law of the land. Then why is it that these millions of people do what they do? And when I say they do what they do, I mean they don't do the things I mentioned. Why is that? Listen. Because they choose to. There's no law about it. They choose to. And so they choose to in their 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and die. Choosing to leave God out. Now tell me who sent them to eternal punishment. Who did so? Surely all God is saying is, your will be done. While you had opportunity, you chose to leave me out. And so I'm left out forever. You say, well, is that the central message of the Bible? Is that what we've come into church to hear tonight? No. The central message of the Bible is, in spite of that, God loved the world so much that He gave His only begotten Son so that whoever trusts in Him should not perish but have eternal life. That God Himself has intervened in the affairs of this world that's gone wrong in the person of Jesus Christ that 2,000 years ago he came into the world to, well, to save sinners, to bring them into a living relationship with himself, so that even if things do go wrong, he is with them, to help them and strengthen them and guide them and comfort them, and to show them a meaning to life that they never had before, and eventually to take them to be with him in glory forever. And I can hear the skeptics saying, well, there you are, you see. That's all that Heath has to say and all that these churches in Cardiff have to say. Pie in the sky when you die. Oh no, much more than that. And when I bring the meeting to a close, I want to zero in more practically and directly on the day-by-day answer to our question, where is God when things go wrong? But, as the minister indicated at the beginning, I always like in these meetings to have a time for interaction, for questions and answers, and we want to do that now. I'm going to sit down for about 1 minute, have a drink of water, and take my first breath since 7:30, and give you a chance to take part. If you want to agree with what I've said, endorse what I've said, please do so in about 15 seconds. If you want to disagree, by all means disagree. Just say whatever it is you want to say, that's absolutely fine. And if you want to ask a question, please ask whatever question you want to ask on our subject. And please ask it in English. And I say that deliberately because wherever I was last night, and I've nearly forgotten, Pontardawi, I think, someone way up in the gallery, so I'm looking at you lot up there, asked the question that went on for about 3 minutes in Welsh. I actually thought he was speaking in tongues. But anyway, it was in... and so when he'd finished, I said, God bless you, brother, who's got the next question? And that was the end of that. And I'll say the same if you try that trick on me tonight. But if you have a question on this subject, please answer it, and I'll do my best to answer. And if I can't, look, come and see me afterwards in the hall and give me some contact details, and I will try to find an answer to the question you have. So that's it. I'm going to sit down for about a minute. You make all the noise you like, shuffle and cough and sneeze, but do switch that blessed phone off, and then and nudge the person next to you and say, why don't you ask him? And in 1 minute's time, you'll have your opportunity. Thank you. I think that's about a minute. I may have been a bit generous. So, do we have a roving microphone, do you know? We don't. Okay, that's fine. So, if you want to contribute, all you have to do is to raise your hand and I'll draw attention to you. You'll be pleased to know you don't have to come up here. You just stay where you are, and as long as you speak in a nice, loud, clear voice, then we can take it from there. So if anybody wants to join in, now look, if you don't want to, that's absolutely fine, but I do want to give that opportunity. And so if you do, let me look up in the gallery first. Anybody up there who'd like to make any contribution at all? Just, no, everybody, nobody up there? Okay. Anybody down here on the ground floor? Yes, sir.
The scripture says that sin is the strength of the law. And it also says where there's no law, there's no transgression. So what is it that the people were guilty of from Adam to Moses?
Okay, what is it that people were guilty of from Adam to Moses? They were guilty by nature, they followed that nature. They did go their own way. They did their own thing without a written law. The law of God, as it were, is written on our hearts, and that God has given to all men, with or without the written law of the Scriptures. Even people who don't know what a Bible is are still, and we can't escape the word because they're all over the Bible, they are still sinners, they are still transgressors, they are still godless in heart, even if there's no, if they've never had a written code. And partly, and maybe more than we think, it is given to them by what we call the conscience. So that people with no time for church or Bible or anything else, there's a moral dimension to humanity. I recall some years ago, I think it was in the northwest of England, maybe in Manchester, there was a very difficult murder case to be solved. Very nasty situation. And the police had no clue at all. And so they went to a group of people to see if they could help them track down the killer. And they went to the underworld. They went to people who would think nothing about breaking the law every day of their lives, but would stop short at murder. So they had a moral standard of some kind, but they did have a moral standard. And the police went to the underworld, the thieves and crooks and swindlers and all the rest of it. Can you find out something that would lead us to this person who has committed murder? So even, as it were, without the law that they were reading, there was a moral law in their hearts. That's something that God has given to all men. Somebody else? Yes, sir.
Does God's justice for his allowing things to go wrong subtract from his love? And if it does, how does it do that?
Okay. Does God allowing anything to go wrong subtract from his love? And if so, how does it do that? Now, any question that asks how does what God does here relate to what happens there, there's a very simple answer to the question. It's not an easy one, but it's actually quite simple. Is Christianity is what we call a revealed religion, which is that God has revealed a massive amount to us in his word, the Bible. And where God has not given us revelation, there really is no point in speculation. And that's a mantra of mine. And if God has not revealed how his allowance... I mean, let me tell you the ultimate question that people could ask, and this will save anybody asking it because I'll ask it myself. But then why did God allow evil to arise at all in the first place? If he is... If he knows everything that's going to happen in the future, why did he allow evil to happen when he knew all the terrible things that would follow from it? The answer is, I don't know. And the reason I don't know is, he has not told me. And if he hasn't told me, how in the world am I going to know? Now, you and I, sir, have never met, as far as I know. So you know very little about me. You could go onto my website, discover some things, but you know nothing about how I think and how I react to certain situations, and you won't know unless I tell you. If I tell you, you will know. If I don't tell you, you don't know. So there are certain things that God has told me, and therefore I know, and there are masses of things he hasn't told me, and therefore I don't know. And that to me would be the ultimate question that anybody could ask me is, then why did God allow evil in the first place? And the answer is, I don't know. But I know that evil is here. I know that God is, that he is in control of the entire universe. And somehow those meet. But they don't meet in my mind because that's beyond me. And there are many things that in the Bible that I don't understand. But even the things I don't understand, I stand under. Yes, sir.
The scripture says all things work together for good to them that love the Lord. Have you an answer then to why does he allow bad to?
I've really answered that question already. I simply don't know. But let me tell you, all things work together for good to those who love God. In the front row of my meeting in Pontardawe last night was a man who at 18 months of age was struck blind through measles. Of all things. And there was recently an outbreak of measles in the Swansea area. And so television got hold of him and said, come on television and tell us. I mean, the object was people ought to be vaccinated against this disease. So come on television and tell us how it's wrecked your life and all the rest of it. And therefore, so he went on television and said, it hasn't wrecked my life. It's a wonderful thing has happened to me. And I'm here to testify about God's goodness to me and the way in which he's used my blindness, etc., etc. And so I spoke to him half an hour before I came into the meeting tonight, and he tells me that he's got to have open heart surgery in February, and that the surgeon said to him, you know, this was and still could be quite a dangerous operation, and people have been known to die having this operation as a result of this operation. And my friend said, well, if I die, let me tell you two things of which you can be certain. And the surgeon, I'm sure he blinked and said, oh, really? Tell me. He said, firstly, Heaven must be ready for me, and I must be ready for heaven. Yes, sir.
Does God care when things go wrong? If so, why?
Now, there's another why question. Why does God react in a certain way? Does God care, or is God as careless as that table? Well, I hope you know the answer to that question. God does care. God loved the world and gave his son. Well, that's the answer to your question is that. God loved the world, therefore God does care. If God didn't care, he'd have said, well, they've gone their own way and that's it. I gave them everything that they might know perfection, a perfect relationship with each other in on a perfect planet, in a perfect universe, worshipping a perfect God, and they kicked over the traces. Then forget it. But he cared. Somebody else? Well, that's fine. We'll probably be through by 10:30 now, but we'll carry on. Now, seriously, where is God when things go wrong? But where is God now when things go wrong? When the pain comes and the bad news comes? Where is God? Well, he is still completely in control and still wonderfully loving. Nothing takes God by surprise. There's no red telephone in heaven, no furrowed brows. And he is using even the worst of things to say something to us. C.S. Lewis once brilliantly said, God whispers in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It's his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. That's brilliant. God whispers in our pleasures. I mean, there's much to enjoy in life. God has given us all things richly to enjoy. God isn't a hard-fisted, hard-hearted ogre waiting to wrap us over the knuckles whenever we do something wrong. He is a good, gracious, loving, generous God and wants the very best for us. The trouble is, when we're enjoying life, with all the noise and the music and the color and the friendship and all the rest of it, it's possible to kind of forget God because he's only whispering to us. My blind friend said to me some years ago, and I've never forgotten, John, walk close to God because sometimes he's whispering. Oh, that was great. Never forgotten that. God speaks in our conscience. How much time do you give thinking about your conscience? Now, you may have been wrestling with it for weeks, months, years. But I mean, where is it? Right elbow, behind the left knee, in the small of the back? Somewhere between our ears? And where does it get its authority from? So that it can dictate things to us, make us feel miserable, make us feel happy. Where does it get that power? Lewis would say, God speaks in our conscience. And he shouts in our pains. So when things go wrong, God is saying something to us. And let me suggest some of the things he is saying. Firstly, he is certainly, surely God is saying, you're not in control. And we all tend to think we are in control. Look, we're not in control of the weather. We're not in control of other people. If we were, they would never say anything naughty about us, and they'd always treat us generously. We're not in control of ourselves, or we would never have a guilty feeling about anything we ever did. Surely God is also telling us how frail and fragile we are. I'm a very enthusiastic, highly competitive amateur golfer. And one of my friends was a regular partner with me, played in all kinds of competitions. And I remember one Saturday morning he phoned me up. I live about a mile from the golf club. And he said, John, come out and play. We're teeing off in half an hour. And I said, Norman, I'm too busy. I can't get away from the desk. Oh, come on, that can wait. Come and play golf with me. I said, Norman, look, I'll tell you what, I'll see you next Wednesday morning. Put the phone down. And the following morning, just leaving the home to go to church, and the phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was the steward at the golf club to say, oh, I thought you ought to know that Norman Smith died last night. And I said, oh, well, wait a minute, there are three Norman Smiths in the club, and it can't be the one I was speaking to yesterday. He said, well, he drives a black cab in London. I said, that is the man I mean. It was his 52nd birthday. And he did play golf that morning and went home and cleaned up and went to his brother, I think, for a barbecue to celebrate his birthday and dropped dead. And I preached at his funeral, and one of the things I said about him is that he was a frail man. We called him Storming Norman, after Norman Schwarzkopf in the Middle East. I mean, he was just bustling and hustling and living at 100 miles an hour, and he was gone. And when things go wrong with other people, in spirit at least, we ought to remember it's of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed. We ought in spirit at least to say, when we hear bad news about someone else, there but for the grace of God go I. And surely there are times when God is reminding us of our own sin. You see, it's not God's fault when people lie and steal and cheat and wound and murder and break their marriage vows. If we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. But surely, when things go wrong, God is asking us to examine our own relationship with God. Now, you know exactly where you were when you heard about 9/11. I know where I was. I was on the Channel Island of Jersey. And then I heard the news. I actually went into a shop, and nobody was shopping. They were all looking at this television screen. And I saw that second plane come around and hit the tower. And I was in Jersey for a week and was due to preach that Sunday. 9/11 was on a Tuesday. And like thousands, and I'd done all my preparation, like thousands of preachers all over the world, I scrapped my Sunday sermon and preached instead on a tower falling and many people being killed. Oh, not in New York, in Jerusalem. Oh, and not that Tuesday, 2,000 years earlier. And Jesus said, those 18 who died when the tower fell on them, do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? You see, common wisdom was, if there was a bad accident, many people killed, that was God really zapping them. They must have been a bad lot. So God just wiped them out. So Jesus asked the question, do you think they were the worst people living in Jerusalem? And then before people could answer, he gave them the answer. He said, I tell you no. So that puts an end to that. I tell you, no, they weren't. But unless you repent, you too will all perish. And he wasn't telling them, if I were you, I'd stay away from towers from now on. He was saying, look, unless you change your life, unless you cease being self-centered and become God-centered, unless you have a living relationship with God, you will perish. Oh, and we were there earlier in the meeting. You will perish eternally. So the most important thing for any of us here tonight is that we should have a living relationship with God, that we are in his family and able to draw on his love and grace and strength when things go wrong. 5 years ago, my wife went to the doctor with certain pains, and the doctor said, well, I think you ought to go to hospital and get some tests, which she did. And she was to be in hospital for some hours, and I was to go in later. And when I arrived, the doctor said to us, would you care to sit down, because I have something to tell you that I really wish I didn't have to tell you. And my wife replied, you can tell me anything you like. I'm a Christian. Just tell me the truth. And the doctor said, well, you have colorectal cancer, and it has spread to your liver and lungs. So you're in for a very long journey. There'll be lots of courses of chemotherapy and so forth, and then we'll eventually have some surgery and get rid of this primary. We then went to the Royal Marsden Hospital, which happens to be 5 minutes from home, and there's probably not a better hospital in the world for that condition. And the professor took one look at her, touched her tummy, and she yelped, and the professor said, we'll have that out straight away. So back to the other hospital, had the surgery, very successful. Spoke to her that evening, went to see her that evening, to my amazement. And then the healing from that and a long course of chemotherapy. In fact, 3 years of it. And just over 3 years ago, she died. And the last words she heard me say were these: "Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." The Bible is so honest about this. Here's the Apostle Paul again, writing to a group of Christians who were very concerned about believers who had died earlier and what would happen to them at the end of the world and so forth. And Paul says, look, we grieve. Now, he didn't say, now look, now that we're Christians, you know, we don't grieve. I mean, we just go through life with a happy smile. Doesn't matter what happens. Paul says, no, we grieve. But listen, but not as those who have no hope. Remember what I said earlier? If there is no God, you're on your own. If you don't believe in God, don't trust in God, don't know God, you're on your own. But if you do know God and love Him and trust Him, you're not on your own. Not anymore. So we grieve. Of course we do. I can't tell you. We had, I think, 500 letters or cards after Joyce died. And my study faces the road. And I'd be there and the postman would come up with a pile this big. I remember one horribly embarrassing day when he said, "Wow, have you had a big birthday recently?" And I stopped what I was doing, of course, and went back and started to read them and cried like a baby. Of course I did. We grieve. And so when my sons and I laid Joyce's body in the grave, I said to them, "Mum's not here. This is just her body. She's not here. She's not here." And so if you went to Epsom Cemetery today, very top of the cemetery, you see a beautiful gravestone, black and with gold lettering on it, and her name, date of birth, date of death, and then underneath these words, "with Christ, which is far better." And then a nice big gap. And I know what's going there. And maybe before too long, my name, date of birth, I don't know why that amuses you so much. My date of birth, my date of death. And the reason for the text is this: even when I'm dead, I'll still be preaching. Because people walk past and say, "Well, I remember him. What's he saying?" "With Christ, which is far better." Now, my friend, listen. When you die, assuming you are buried and assuming there is a gravestone, so just with those assumptions to make my point, one of two things could be written on that gravestone about you: "With Christ, which is far better." Better than anything you have ever known in this life. Remember when people used to say to me, "I'm sorry you lost your wife," to which the answer is, "I haven't lost her. I know exactly where she is. And she's in much better company." So either "with Christ, which is far better," or this could be written on your gravestone: "without Christ, which is far worse." Worse than anything you could ever know. You sometimes hear people talk about hell on earth. No, there is no hell on earth. There's hell after earth, after this life, and in the life to come. So where is God when things go wrong? He's where He's always been, loving and utterly in control. Things went wrong, as I close, with a friend of mine called Johnny Farisi. The moment he was born with spinal muscular atrophy, which for a layman means he didn't have the use of arms or legs. Still doesn't. Fully grown man, hasn't been out of pain for 10 minutes, hasn't sat up for 10 years in his bed. Has a great sense of humor, is a great sports fan, runs his own website, please don't ask me how. And I was writing a book when I first came across him called Is God Past His Sell-By Date? And I asked if he would do a testimony at the end of one of the chapters, and he agreed. And I want to read you some of the words that his testimony reads, and you can read them in the book if you can come across it. One of the psalmists wrote, "Come and listen, all you who fear God, and let me tell you what He has done for me, and I gladly do so. He has turned my mourning into laughter and my desolation into joy. He's made my heart rejoice with an inexpressible and glorious joy. When I struggled to escape from his grace, he drew me to himself. I bear witness that never servant had such a master as I have, never brother such a kinsman, never spouse such a husband. No sinner ever had a better Savior than Jesus, no mourner a better comforter. I want none beside him. In life he is my life, and in death he shall be the death of death. In poverty he is my riches, in sickness my health, in darkness my sun. Jesus is to me all grace and no wrath, all truth and no falsehood, and of truth and grace he is full, infinitely full. And Johnny Farisi, who is now very close to death, could have said on his gravestone with Christ, which is far better. And I know that the desire of this church in all of its ministries and its reason for inviting me tonight is merely, and that's hardly the word to use, that the reason is that as many people as would come within these four walls would hear the message that God is, that he is the creator, that he is all powerful, that he is all loving, and that he wants you to know that love, that grace, that help, that strength, that comfort in your life day by day, and that one day you would go to be with him forever. So as we close, let me just say these two or three very practical things. Firstly, again, sir, to thank you for inviting me to come tonight and giving me the privilege of being in this church again. Secondly, to remind you that our evening isn't over, just my, this part of it is, and that we're going to meet, I hope, all of us, most of us, in the hall. Please don't ask me how to get there. To get from here to the hall requires local knowledge or a sat-nav, but it's not far away. It's out there somewhere. Is it out there? There, see, I told you, it's that way. And there are refreshments there, and I've seen them, and I can't wait to get at them. And also, my good friend Howard Williams is there. Howard Williams lives in Lancashire, and travels with me on all my tours. This week I've been in Llanelli and Pontardawe and Bridgend and here. Tomorrow I'm in Newport on Saturday in Gloucester and Sunday in Gloucester, on Tuesday in Atlanta, Georgia, and so it goes on. And Howard is with me all the time doing these things, and he is in charge of the books that my publishers very kindly make available big discounts in the course of these meetings. You may have had a leaflet, I think many of you did, as you came in. Now, please take that leaflet away with you and you'd be able to order any of those things. But here's what I want you to do. If you want to order anything from that leaflet, other than the things I'm going to mention in just one moment, please get them from your local bookshop here at this very address, number 122. I've seen bookshops around the country, and I've not seen a better one than this. Robin Haight has been a model of courtesy and helpfulness in planning the meeting tonight, and he has a great range of books there that could be a great help to you, and I encourage you as warmly as I can to get your Christian books from that bookshop. Support it in every way that you possibly can. However, we have got just two titles I want to mention ever so briefly, and then one I'll say a little more about, and then we're free to go. Unusually, there are two biographies of me on the book table. One is called Travel with John Blanchard, which is produced by Day One, 128 pages, 150 photographs. Day One have done a wonderful job of travel guides for John Bunyan, C.H. Spurgeon, Martin Lloyd-Jones, C.S. Lewis, and others, and for their own strange reasons, wanted me to be part of that series. And so Brian Edwards, one of our finest preachers and writers, has written that very colourful biography, just masses of pictures, and I did look very handsome when I was 5 years old, and so all of those are there. And the second is called Hear Me Carefully, a phrase you've heard at least once tonight, and was written by Howard Williams, the man you'll see back there, written by his wife last year to commemorate, well, I'll give the game away, my 80th birthday and my 50th year in the ministry. Were celebrated. They had a dinner in my honor in London, and she, all unknown to me, had craftily gone behind the scenes and written this biography called Hear Me Carefully. And then also as part of the same story, Christian Television Association made a film of my life, and this time they couldn't do it secretly because I had to be in it, and so they travelled with me to Guernsey, where I was born, and to Isla in the Hebrides, where I was evacuated during the war, and to the United States, and to mainland England, and mainland Scotland, and to Albania, and they did 25 hours of recording altogether, of filming, and then they eventually boiled it all down to this DVD called Going Strongly for the Summit, which is a story of my life and all kinds of bits of preaching and travel and so forth in there. And Howard Williams does have copies of that, and I think, again, it's at about half price. I know the two biographies are. But then there's a book that you've certainly not seen before, and therefore you've not, and certainly not read. And the reason is, I think it's only being published this week. But I do know that I've been able to snaffle several hundred copies direct from the printers before it even reached the publisher. And it's called The Hitchhiker's Guide to Heaven. And that's appropriate at the end of our message this evening, because there are massive questions that people ask about heaven. Well, where exactly is it? And who goes there? And how do we get there? And what happens when we get there? And do we spend eternity floating on clouds strumming harps? And can we really be joyful in heaven if we think back to the kind of people we were on earth? And can we really have undiluted joy if we know of people who are not in heaven? And what does it mean about there being a new heavens and a new earth? Where does all that fit in? Is this earth going to be obliterated, or will this earth be here forever and be part, if you were, of heaven? Now, all of those questions I've sought to address in this book. It's called The Hitchhiker's Guide to Heaven. And as I say, probably going to be published next week. But so this tour, including tonight in Heath, this is the launch of the book. And to mark that launch, we've done something that will not ever be done again. But I can do it this week, taking a deep breath. And I'm not going to encourage you to buy a copy of the book. I'm going to encourage you to buy two. For this reason, you can buy two from Howard Williams tonight for less than the price of one in the weeks to come. That may not appeal to you one little bit, and I understand. And if so, you need help. So to repeat, you see Howard Williams afterwards. If you want to buy one, you would have to pay a little more for that. But if you want to get two, and you can give one away to somebody else, or that season that begins with a C and ends with M-A-S is not that far away, and you may think that would make an ideal Xmas present. And anyway, for whatever reason, if you want to get two of those, you'll find that you can get two for less than the price of one. And because people have asked me all this week, so many have gone this week, we had to get another 100 sent in today, and they mercifully arrived today right here at Heath. And so Howard Williams has them out there. And because I've been asked every night this week if I would sign copies of the book, I'll be willing to do that because I'll be out there. In fact, I'll tell you what, I'll put a chair somewhere near the table. It's that way. Somewhere near the table, and then I'll be happy to talk to you there. Let me pray, and then I'll see you next door. Our gracious God, thank you for the truth that you've spoken to us through your word. Take from our minds anything said tonight that's been a mere human invention and device, but do write the truth in our hearts and minds and help us to respond as we should to your glory and to our good, for Jesus' sake. Amen.